Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is May 21st, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, Should Patients with a Concussion Be Told to Walk This Way? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Lauren Westerfer. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, Bay State. She is the co-founder of Foamcast and a pulmonary embolism and implementation science researcher. Dr. Westerfer serves as the social media editor and a research methodology editor for Annals of Emergency Medicine and an associate editor for the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal Watch Emergency Medicine. Welcome back to the SGEM, Lauren.
Thanks, Ken. Always happy to be back looking at papers with you.
Well, congrats. On your recent award from the Society of Academic Emergency Medicine, you won the FOMED Excellence in Education Award.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate it. I'm just trying to follow in your footsteps because I think you won that a couple of years ago. So just trying to live up to it.
I thought you would be an awesome person to win that award.
Thanks, Ken. Should we move into a case here?
Sure. Yeah. Sorry. Enough embarrassing talk about all your awards. Let's get into a case.
All right, we have a 32-year-old female who presents with headache after a low-speed motor vehicle collision as a restrained driver. She was ambulatory on scene. The patient is not anticoagulated, has no midline neck pain, and no evidence of any other injuries. She's generally well-appearing without any deficits on neurologic exam. Given her minor mechanism and her normal neurologic exam, no imaging or further testing is required, but you tell her you believe she has a concussion.
Well, concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries are commonly diagnosed in the emergency department. Most patients recover within the first week. However, 15 to 30% of patients develop persistent post-concussive symptoms.
And historically, cognitive and physical rest have been recommended following the diagnosis of these mild traumatic brain injuries. And patients have been advised to resume exercise only once the symptoms have completely resolved. Recent studies, though, have challenged this dogma, as a multi-center study found that early return to physical activity within a week of injury was associated with an improvement in time to symptom reduction.
I do like challenging dogma. One of the issues that comes up with minor head injuries is we do not need to get advanced imaging. We looked at the Canadian CT head rule published by the legend of emergency medicine, Dr. Ian Steele, in The Lancet 2001 on SGEM number 106. You can find this clinical decision instrument on MD Calc, and I'll put the infographic of this clinical decision instrument in the show notes.
The SGEM has also covered the issue of getting CT scans in pediatric patients with minor head injuries that use the PCARN data, which has a protocol for kids less than 2 years of age and those older than 2 years of age.
And on SGEM number 112 on pediatric concussions, we covered a study that asked if there is a benefit to recommending strict rest after a child has a concussion. The bottom line from that SGEM episode was that in children with concussion, 2 days of rest followed by a gradual return of activity is preferred over 5 days of rest followed by a gradual return to activity. The longer strict rest period appears to cause more post-concussive symptoms.
We've also looked at the diagnostic accuracy of the Canadian CT head rule in patients 65 years of age or older in predicting clinically important brain injuries. That was SGEM 266. The published study opened the door for reducing the number of unnecessary head CT scans, which is a good thing, in the cohort of patients, but further high-quality prospective studies are required prior to clinical application.
Well, let's get back to the issue of concussions, though. There is limited information on the best strategy for preventing post-concussive syndrome. So, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
Are patients presenting to the emergency department with mild concussion who are prescribed light exercise less likely to develop post-concussive syndrome at 30 days compared with those given standard discharge instructions?
And what's the reference we're using, Lauren?
This is Varner et al., a randomized trial comparing prescribed light exercise to standard management for emergency department patients with acute mild traumatic brain injury, academic emergency medicine, May 2021.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Adults ages 18 to 64 years old presenting to the emergency department with mild traumatic brain injury. And this was defined as a direct blow to the body with force transmitted to the head that resulted in somatic, cognitive, emotional, or behavioral or sleep symptoms within the prior 48 hours.
And there were some exclusions that included patients with acute intracranial injury, multi-system injuries preventing light exercise, GCS less than 15 at time of discharge, intoxication at time of discharge, or inability for telephone follow-up. What was the intervention?
48 hours of rest and then gradual return to usual activity with a prescription for 30 minutes of light exercise daily, say, for example, walking for 30 minutes daily.
And that's where we got the theme music. Should we be advising patients to walk this way? And what did they compare it to?
48 hours of rest and then gradual return to usual activity, but instructed not to exercise until symptoms had resolved or they'd been advised to do so by a medical provider.
All right, let's run through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome of this study?
This was the proportion of patients with post-concussive syndrome at 30 days, and they defined this as the presence of three or more symptoms on something called the Rivermead Post-Concussion Symptoms Questionnaire, or the RPQ, and that was at 30 days.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
So this was the change in that same score, the RPQ, from baseline to 7 days, 14 days, and 30 days after the initial ED visit, as well as things like the number of days of missed school or work and repeat visits to a healthcare provider.
Well, if you haven't realized already, this is an SGEM hot off the press episode, which means we have the lead author on the show. Dr. Catherine Varner is an emergency physician and clinician scientist at the Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute of Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto, and an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Her research areas of interest are in both concussion and obstetrical emergencies.
Awesome. Welcome to the SGEM, Catherine.
Thanks so much, Ken and Lauren, for the invitation, and I'm happy to be here to answer some questions about our trial.
Well, I noted that you have some rock star Canadian researchers included on the study, and this includes Kirsten DeWitt, who was on SGEM number 118, and the amazing Dr. Shelley McLeod. Would you like to give a shout out to any other of your co-authors?
Sure. So as you know, Ken, being Canadian, we have a pretty small emergency medicine research community, and we're fairly tight-knit, but we're small and mighty, and I would describe us as pretty friendly. And Dr. McLeod and Dr. DeWitt are just exemplar researchers, and anything they touch seems to turn to gold, and we were just really lucky to have a great Canadian team working on this project.
Excellent. You know, Catherine, I did have a question here. Use the RPQ for your primary outcome, and this isn't something I'm super familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit more about this tool before we dive in?
Yeah, so it's the Rivermead Post-Concussion Symptom Questionnaire, and it's a self-reported scale that measures the severity of post-concussive symptoms following a mild traumatic brain injury. And it asks participants to compare their symptoms at the time of assessment to before their injury on a scale of 0 to 4, which means 0, they have no symptoms at all, and 1 is actually that they've had no more of a problem than they've had before, and 4 is a severe problem. And the questionnaire has 16 defined symptoms and 2 undefined symptoms and has been used in both emergency departments and sports med clinics, and has also been used in research studies and telephone follow-up.
Well, thank you for bringing us up to speed on the RPQ. Can you give the conclusions to your paper?
In this trial of prescribed early light exercise for acute mild traumatic brain injury, there were no differences in recovery or healthcare utilization outcomes. Results suggest that early light exercise may be encouraged as tolerated at ED discharge following MTBI, but this guidance is not sufficient to prevent PCS.
All right, so let's run through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. There's 11 questions. The first question is, the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, Ken.
Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, they were.
And did they conceal the randomization process?
Yep.
Did they analyze the patients into the groups to which they were randomized?
They did.
Did they recruit their cohort consecutively?
No, here 209 patients were missed.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with regards to prognostic factors?
They were.
Now, were all participants, This is the patients, the clinicians, the outcome assessors. So we're looking for a triple blinded study. Were all of them unaware of group allocation?
No, and this is because the physicians treating the patients were aware of group allocation. They were giving the discharge instructions and they had to tell people what to do, as were the patients, since they were the ones that were having to engage in the exercise.
All groups were they treated equally except for the intervention?
Unsure. Here I'm going to quote the paper. Patients may have sought medical attention for other healthcare providers or other self-treatment sources following their index ED visit and received different advice, which may have altered their level of daily physical activity.
Number 9, was the follow-up complete?
No, follow-up was 75% in the control group and 66% in the intervention group.
Yeah, we, you know, just as a general rule, we like to see 80% follow-up, but that's just a guideline. The 10th question, all patient important outcomes were considered.
Yeah, I think so.
And do you think the treatment effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
Well, let's run through the results then. They enrolled 367 patients with a median age of 32 years, and 57% were female. The most common mechanism of injury was a fall. This was 1/3 of the time, followed by bike or motor vehicle accident, and that was 28% of the time. 1/3 of the included patients had a history of anxiety, and more than 1/4 had a history of depression. 1/3 of patients had a history of previous concussion. Lauren, what was the key result from this paper?
No statistical difference between the light exercise group and the comparison group.
Yeah, and for that primary outcome, this was the proportion of patients with post-concussion syndrome at 30 days. What were the actual numbers?
This was 13.4% in the control group versus 14.6% in the intervention group.
And so that gives an absolute difference between the two groups of just over 1%, and this was not statistically significant. How about the secondary outcomes?
So looking at the median change of RPQ scores, the number of return visits to a healthcare provider, the number of missed days of work or school, those were not different between groups.
There were more unplanned return ED visits within 30 days in the control group, just about 10%, compared with the intervention group, which is about half that, just over 5%. However, this did not reach statistical significance. Well, on the Hot Off the Press episodes, we like to talk nerdy with the lead author. So we have 5 nerdy questions for Dr. Varner about her study. Are you ready to go and get nerdy with us, Catherine?
I am.
All right, let's get nerdy. The first question is about lack of blinding. Both the physician and the patient knew their group allocation. Did they know the hypothesis of the study, though? It would have been good to get some baseline data on what the physicians and patients thought was the best. Is it best to have strict bed rest or early light exercise to try to control for any preconceived notions that could have influenced? And what I mean by influenced is bias, something that systematically moves us away from the quote unquote truth or the true point estimate of any effect.
So I'm really glad you asked this question, Ken. In our emergency department, we ran a randomized trial on concussion patients a few years ago. And so in preparing this protocol, we were a bit worried about contamination of the intervention discharge instructions in particular. And so we had to not officially poll, but discuss with our group if they felt comfortable with the discharge instructions that we were providing and comfortable reading the script that we had prepared for them. Because I was surprised to find that our group was fairly evenly split about how they counseled patients normally regarding exercise. So we did spend quite a bit of time ensuring all members in the group, as well as at the other two sites, were comfortable.
So that's why interviewing the lead author gives so much more information, because it sounds like there was a bit of equipoise in your department. Some people would say strict bed rest, whereas others might say, no, get out and get starting to do physical activity when you feel up to it. So it's good that there was some equipoise potentially to minimize the bias, and that you standardized a script that it sounds like everybody went, okay, I'm comfortable with this sort of general script that I can read to patients who are involved in this study.
Yeah, I always learn a lot about my colleagues when I'm running a randomized trial.
Yeah, this is great, but the practice pattern variation is interesting. I have another question. It's on the adherence to the assigned groups. So participants in the control group reported 30 minutes of light exercise at 7 days. So 30 minutes over 7 days. And those in the light exercise group reported 35 minutes. A similar relationship was found at all measured time points. And so this suggests to me that adherence in the intervention group, where it was 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week that was advised after the first 48 hours, was pretty low. And so it's doubtful that a difference of 5 minutes of exercise over the course of a week or 30 days would really have a measurable difference. So I wouldn't expect to see a difference between groups if there was no difference in light exercise between groups. What do y'all make of this?
Reflecting on this question is that we have to remember the goals of the study. So one of the main goals of the study was to determine what would happen if physicians in the emergency department discharging patients were advising patients to participate in light exercise while also handing the patient an exercise prescription. So this is a very pragmatic trial whereby we wanted the results to be reproduced in any emergency department anywhere. And so while we did not find participants had a marked clinically important difference in their participation or amount of exercise, we also found that they did not have bad outcomes after receiving these instructions from their treating physician. So the trial opens up a real conversation about how we instruct patients following a concussion, given the light exercise instructions and the prescription did not increase the likelihood of persistent symptoms. And would our trial have been more rigorous had it been able to provide a fitness instructor and a symptom monitoring treadmill to every patient enrolled in the trial? Absolutely. But this trial would not be relevant to my practice or my patients in the emergency department. And so again, we wanted to design a trial that could be reproduced in any emergency department anywhere.
Yeah, I like that it's a pragmatic trial and gives you an idea of what would happen in real life. That's great.
And I think it highlights another point that it's been shown that adherence in the structure of a randomized control trial or some study is much better than in the wild. And this is sort of halfway in between, roughly, you know, with a pragmatic trial. But even in a pragmatic trial, you could expect that adherence would be better than in the wild. Just like when you went to your colleagues and said, you know, what are your discharge instructions for concussion patients? And found that there was a fairly wide practice variation. So I really think that's an important aspect to keep in mind when we're reading studies. The adherence that we see, even in pragmatic trials, is probably better than what we see in the real world. The third point was about potential biases. Participants self-reported how frequently and for how many minutes they exercised at 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month. This could have introduced some reporting bias. Without making diary entries or other near real-time entries, it's difficult to tell whether participants were reporting accurately over or under reporting their physical activity.
This is another great point, Ken, and this is one we struggled with a lot in designing the trial and in the first few months of the trial. So unfortunately, there's always going to be some patient recall bias for self-reported outcomes like daily activity. And in fact, in the first drafts of the trial protocol, we had included fitness trackers and ultimately removed them because we were worried about the potential for them to encourage both groups to exercise more. Once you get a fancy device, often it makes people do things differently. And then it's funny you bring up daily activity diaries because we did include daily activity diaries in the first 40 patients that we enrolled. And so we would send all enrolled patients home with a daily activity diary with a pre-postage paid and pre-addressed envelope. And we only received about one or two of these diaries. And so, and several patients actually cited, or trial participants cited this as a reason to discontinue being a part of the trial. And so we ultimately abandoned it. And so it was a recognized challenge of the trial.
Again, more information, more layers to the study.
I think think, you know, thinking about how hard it is to run trials and things that I think about when I'm looking at a trial and biases, one of the things that often comes up is sort of like a selection bias. So in this study, nearly 20% of potentially eligible patients were missed for a variety of reasons. And this could have introduced some selection bias. And, you know, it would be nice to have information on those that were missed for inclusion in this trial, because, you know, we don't know if these patients were somehow different than those were ultimately enrolled in the trial. Can you just talk to us a little bit about this?
Absolutely. So I love talking about how challenging it is to run a prospective research study in the emergency department. It's so different than running a clinical trial in like an oncology clinic that's open during business hours with pre-scheduled appointments weeks in advance and regular follow-up visits. And running a clinical trial in an acute care setting is an entirely different animal. I mean, we're open 24/7, 365. And while we and the Hamilton sites do have research assistants in the department Monday to Friday, 8 to 5, and some volunteer medical students in the evenings, we're dependent on physicians and nurses to enroll patients out of hours. And amazingly, we did enroll patients out of hours, but the majority of missed eligible patients were during these overnight periods when we're all busy seeing patients and taking care of people clinically. And so research can become an afterthought. So could the results be more applicable to patients presenting in the middle of the day with a head injury? Absolutely, that's certainly possible. But I don't think that I would change my instructions for patients based on the time of day that they're presenting to our emergency department.
I think research funders need to be aware of the 24/7, 365 nature of emergency medicine. They're probably aware of that, but they need to fund it if we want to do higher quality research so we can capture it. But researchers need to be funded and have the tools to be able to do that as well. The fourth nerdy point was about the cohort. The patients included in this trial had 2 to 3 times higher history of mood or anxiety disorder than reported in the adult Canadian population. And the reason I know that is because when I was going through, okay, what are the basic demographics of the cohort? All right, the median age was 32, 57% were female. But those numbers about 2 to 3 times higher history of mood and anxiety disorders really jumped out at me. So I got online and started doing a little research and trying to find out what the adult Canadian population reporting of mood and anxiety disorder is, and it's 2 to 3 times lower than what was reported in the study. Do you think this could have impacted your results and limited the external validity to other populations?
It's a great point, Ken, and also speaks to doing research in emergency medicine. And so while I don't know the exact numbers, you know, patients presenting to emergency departments in Canada, and I would suspect other parts of the world, do have higher rates of anxiety and mood disorders than in the general population. I also think that the patient population probably resembles other populations presenting to the emergency department. In fact, patients in one of the only other large prospective multicenter longitudinal studies by the TRAC TBI group in the U.S. also had higher baseline rates of mood disorders than the general population. And it speaks to how important it is to recognize anxiety and mood disorders and how they affect MTBI patients. And in this month's Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine, we published a secondary analysis which found 5 variables that were significant predictors of post-concussive symptoms. And having a history of anxiety or depression was one of variables that independently predicted post-concussion symptoms at 30 days. And so it's also possible that patients with mood disorders are more likely to have symptoms on the first day following a concussion, which could also account for the high baseline prevalence in our study.
So it sounds like you were intrigued by that number as well with regards to the population in your cohort.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot more research that could be done, particularly in the patients who have anxiety and mood disorders and are presenting with head injury.
I have the final and fifth point here for you. And it speaks again to how hard trials are in the emergency department specifically. And that has to do with loss to follow-up, which is a challenge in clinical medicine from the ED as well as research. And so in this study, nearly 30% of patients who were randomized did not have 30-day follow-up. And so one concern when this happens is with the significant amount of loss to follow-up is that there may be a difference in the characteristics or outcomes of those who follow up and those who did not. So for example, did a patient not follow up because they were still symptomatic and didn't feel well? Or alternatively, perhaps those patients had no symptoms and so they were like, yep, done, I'm out of here, I'm less likely to follow up. What are some of your thoughts on this and when y'all looked into it?
Yeah, so we too are really concerned about the loss to follow up. And I can tell you, I lost sleep about this for sure. And these are young patients with busy lives. And in our previous work, we found this particular population less likely to follow up than other populations that we do research with in the emergency department. And so we tried everything and for that our RAB allowed. That included text messaging patients, sending them email reminders, you know, everything that was within the bounds of research ethics. And so, you know, at the end of the day, to account for the attrition we found in the trial, we did do some analysis to compare the characteristics of patients who completed follow-up to those who did not. And we found that there were no baseline differences between the two groups. And we don't have any reason to believe that the intervention, for instance, would have made patients more or less likely to complete their follow-up.
Excellent. That's helpful.
Well, those are our five nerdy questions. It's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So we think that the loss to follow-up and the lack of difference between the two groups for minutes of daily exercise prevent us from really making any super strong conclusions.
So what are our not super strong conclusions then? The SGEM bottom line.
After a couple of days of rest, it is reasonable to suggest patients with mild traumatic brain injury or concussion start light physical exercise if they're feeling well enough.
And how about a case resolution?
So our patient is sent home with discharge instructions allowing for light physical exercise, 30 minutes a day of walking or so after that initial 48-hour period of rest.
And the clinical application of this study, Lauren?
So, you know, I do think that this is applicable because when has strict bed rest been good for anything? Mental health, physical health, anything. So once people are feeling better, it's reasonable and it seems logical for them to start some level of light activity. While this study doesn't provide robust evidence for light physical activity, we don't have any good evidence that strict rest, so the dogma that you gotta rest strictly, provides a patient-oriented benefit. So given the lack of compelling information to guide our care in either direction, it's reasonable to allow patients to start light activities a couple of days after their mild traumatic brain injury.
And Catherine, before we actually recorded this podcast, when we were discussing having you on as a guest, we actually touched upon this in a conversation. When is strict bed rest good for anything? And you had some comments about that.
I mean, I think countless times we've discovered that we've been telling patients the wrong thing about how to treat their bodies after injury, whether it's ankle injuries or back injuries. And, you know, I think this trial opens the conversation, as some other prospective studies have done, about allowing patients to make some of their own decisions about whether or not they're returning to exercise, as opposed to saying you should not exercise, it's bad following a mild traumatic brain injury.
It's like personalized medicine. You actually direct them to have some agency and some autonomy and personalize their recovery based on how they're feeling. You engage with them in some shared decision-making and say, if you're feeling up to it, okay, some light activity like walking might be fine. If you're not feeling up to it, that's okay too. But this whole idea of thou shalt not do this for 48 hours or thou shalt only do this at 7 days and must increase on this schedule, when has that ever worked for anything? Well, Lauren, what are you going to tell the patient?
So I would tell them that it appears that you have a concussion, and while you recover, it's very important to prevent another head injury. So that means doing things like avoiding contact sports, no rugby. Most people get better within a few days, but some patients do have persistent symptoms. And while we recommend you take it easy over the next 2 days or so, if you're feeling better, then you can start reintroducing some light exercise, something like walking. If you're getting worse or you're worried, you can come back to the emergency department or follow up with your doctor for reassessment.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And last week's winner was Dr. Riker Keel from Douglas, Wyoming. He knew that Godfrey Housefield is the person that invented the first CT scanner. Lauren, what's the question this week?
What year was the Rivermead Post-Concussion Symptoms Questionnaire first presented?
Yes, we're looking for the year that this was first presented, and this was the outcome measure used in this concussion study. So if you know the answer, then just send me an email at thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
All right, now this is a Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine hot off the press. So now it's your turn, SGEMers. What do you think of this episode on activity after mild traumatic brain injury? Tweet your comments. Remember to use #SGEMHOP. And what questions do you have for Catherine and her team? That's the great part about this podcast. You have her. You can ask her the questions about this research. Ask them on the blog. The best social media feedback will be published in Academic Emergency Medicine.
And part of the process will be to put up a Twitter poll. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what people are doing. What are clinicians advising when someone has a mild traumatic brain injury, a concussion? Are they, like Catherine's group, sort of split between, yeah, it's okay to go back and do some light physical activity, or strict bed rest or strict rest for an extended period of time? It'll be interesting to see if the Twitter polls reflect what she found in her own practice environment. But don't forget, those who are subscribers to AEM can head over to the AEM homepage and get some CME credits for this podcast and article. But even those who don't subscribe can earn CME credits now for the SGEM episodes. All you have to do is click on the link in the SGEM blog and support this free open access to medical education project. The content is always free, but there's a small little fee for the CME.
Thank you, Dr. Varner, for coming back on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine and talking about your hot off the press publication.
Well, thanks to you both for this opportunity, and hopefully someday we can all meet up in person.
Well, you know what? Lauren is going to be presenting to the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians in the best literature track, so at least we'll be able to meet up virtually if you're signing up for the CAPE conference in June. Thank you, Lauren, for coming on and helping with the knowledge translation.
Always excited to talk a little nerdy with y'all.
And to finish the show, Catherine, we need you to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.